From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. California knows all about drought. It is part of life in the Golden State. But the drought right now is shaping up to be a historically bad one. A drought emergency has been declared. It's a moment of reckoning for California, its farmers, its cities, its water infrastructure, a dress rehearsal for what many now fear may be a drier future. This hour on Point, the California drought emergency. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How will California cope, and what are we learning in the Great Western Drought? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Welcome to our new listeners in Abilene, Texas, on 89.7 KACU today. We look forward to hearing from you. Texas knows a little bit about drought. Sound from California, here's Governor Jerry Brown proclaiming a drought emergency for the state on Friday, January 17th. The governor said California is in the midst of perhaps its worst dry spell in a century.
I'm declaring a drought emergency in the state of California because we're facing perhaps the worst drought that California has ever seen since records began being kept about 100 years ago.
100 years. California's Water Authority, launching a new series of public service announcements, began airing last week. This one focuses on water use in the home.
We're in a drought, and the governor is asking Californians to reduce their water use by 20%, take shorter showers, fix broken sprinklers, check for leaks.
Of course, it's hitting farmers hard, too, many of them. Here's a California farmer by the name of Paul Van Leer talking to Al Jazeera America about what drought means for his cattle and 1,800-acre farm.
If we don't get rain in a 30-day or so window, we'll be in pretty much dire straits. So we're faced with no feed and cows that need feed. So it's devastating. You have these animals that you know by name, some of them, if you raised up, and you have no choice. You have to let them go.
We'll look at the food implications of California's current drought and more in this hour. Joining us first from Los Angeles is Bettina Boxall. She covers water and environmental issues for the LA Times. Bettina, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Bettina, California has such a history of drought. Drought is a fact of California life. What is different this time?
Well, it may be more prolonged and more severe than the droughts that we've experienced in our recent history. That's not to say that it's more prolonged or severe than droughts that California suffered, before it was settled. I mean, the West and California have a long history of severe drought, but we have a short memory and a short settlement in historical terms in California, so we're used to more water. But so far, I mean, we actually were in worse shape at this point in 1977 and some previous years. The problem is that it looks like we're just not going to be getting much precipitation, many storms at all this winter. I mean, we just have one monotonously sunny day after another. And I know you in the East are probably envying that, but we are, frankly, quite sick of it.
You're right in the middle of what should be the rainy season now. What is that rainy season? I mean, we know for most of the year, California doesn't get much rain, but now what ideally would or should be happening?
What should be happening is snow should be piling up in the Sierra, and the non-mountainous parts should be getting rainstorms, and the reservoir should be filling up, and we should be, getting storage in place for the dry season. I mean, we typically get our precipitation from about October until April, and then it just shuts down pretty much all over the state, and we always have a summer drought. And the way California has handled that is by, farmers have irrigation, and we have a huge reservoir system and a very sophisticated, complicated water system that conveys water from the north to the south and to farmlands. And the problem is that those stores are not being refilled, and the Sierra, when you fly over the peaks now, they are depressingly bare. I mean, the snowpack is something like 17, and the snowpack is the water content of the snow. It's about 17% of average for this time of year, and there's this horrible high ridge system that has been blocking storms coming in that we usually get. There is some suggestion that it may be breaking up a little bit in February, but the overall forecasts are the dry weather is going to continue, and that is what is particularly worrisome.
Normally, you'd have storms coming down from the Gulf of Alaska, a lot of that falling in the mountains, saved up as snowpack, and then later used by all of the state. Meteorologically, what exactly is happening that's created this drought situation?
There is a very persistent high ridge system that's very long, very deep, that is parked off the West Coast, and it has been there, and usually, we get these high ridge systems, but usually they move on. This one, for reasons that meteorologists can't really explain, has not. It has just stayed there, and so it is pushing the storms that we would normally get north. And there are also climatologists that think we're in, a bigger climate phase called the, are you ready for this, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation,
okay,
where ocean temperatures are stuck in a long-term, what we would call La Nina phase, sort of like a big La Nina, where the ocean temperatures in the eastern Pacific get cooler. And again, it does the same thing of pushing the jet stream moves north, and it pushes the storms north of us. So we're just stuck in the wrong place right now.
And what part of California is being hit worst or the most by this, or is it everybody?
Well, the whole state is dry. But in terms of immediate effects, it is unevenly being felt. I mean, agriculture is the predominant water user of in California. So they, of course, are going to be the first to suffer because they use most of the developed water supply. And the big metropolitan areas in Southern California are actually, should be okay for this year. Southern California, sort of had a wake-up call in the last big drought in the late 80s and early 90s and has done quite a bit in terms of conservation, built a large, reservoir in Southern California. So water managers in Southern California say that we have enough ample, supplies to get us through this year. That's not to say that they're not calling for, increased conservation. And the same is true of San Francisco. They're probably in decent shape. But smaller communities that just depend on very local surface supplies and precipitation, I wrote about a small town in Mendocino County, which is on the northern coast of California, north of San Francisco. And they only, as of about 2 weeks ago, they only had 100 days of supply left because they depend on two small municipal reservoirs that are filled by precipitation, and they just haven't been getting that rain. So there are communities like that that are going to be in particularly bad shape, and some of the first to be hit in terms of the agricultural community are ranchers, who have grazing lands, and of course the grass isn't growing, and it's going to be quite serious for much of California's agriculture.
We're going to talk later in this hour about food coming out of California, how that might be hit by this. I mean, you've had 13 drought emergencies since 1987, so this is not uncommon, but I guess climate and climate change awareness is greater than ever. Are people talking about this in bigger, deeper terms this time, Bettina? I mean, California's always had drought, but it's more populous than ever as well. Does this state still work?
Well, actually, the population isn't driving water use. California has actually got like 3 million more people than it did 20 years ago, and we're using the same amount of water. I mean, because there still is a fair amount of slack in the system, and so I think this is fitting into a larger conversation that California has been having for a good decade about a greater recognition that we live in a semi-arid state that is prone to drought. And we have to get better at recognizing that and responding to it. And so I think that this will, reinforce that message, which some parts of the state have absorbed more deeply than other parts of the state. And in terms of climate change, it's the predictions with precipitation are actually somewhat uncertain. It's certainly clear that we're going to get less snow, that it will be falling as rain instead of snow. So that's going to change basically what we have in the snowpack in the Sierras. We have a natural reservoir system that releases you know, snow melt very gradually at the time of year when agriculture needs it. And so we're going to be getting, you know, with climate change, we're getting less snow and more rain. And so it's going to have to change the way we do things. But I mean, it's not the end of the world for California. I mean, there are many things that we can do to respond to this, and situations like this drought reinforce that message, and I think will, you know, speed along the adaptations to a future that cannot be the same as the past. You know, we have to stop using water the way we have for the past century, which is rather carelessly.
But Tina, what about the politics of this? We've just got a minute with you here, but we had John Boehner in California saying, why is California using water for fish when people need it? I'm looking at a report here of coho salmon threatened with extinction by the drought. We saw the bears running across the ski slope. I don't know if that means they can't hibernate. It's too warm, or they always run around the ski slopes. What about the politics of man versus natural environment in this drought?
Well, droughts are always political. Whatever anyone's agenda is, whether it's more conservation, you know, less environmental regulation, people will use drought to advance that. And so there is, you know, longstanding conflict with Central Valley agriculture, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, and endangered species protections that have reduced deliveries through sort of the main hub of California water, which is the delta east of San Francisco. Those protections have reduced deliveries to protect some endangered species, and that's long been resented by San Joaquin Valley agriculture. But the fact is that those protections haven't kicked in this year, and they have not restricted any restricted deliveries to the San Joaquin Valley since last February.
Yeah, and still it's a political issue we see in John Boehner's visit. Bettina Boxall with the LA Times, thank you very much for being here, Bettina.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about California's big drought emergency now. Of course, it has been hot and dry, and there has been, in addition to everything else, a lot of fire in California. Here's Daryl Osby, fire chief in Los Angeles County, talking with NBC a couple of weeks ago as his crews were struggling with a wildfire in the foothills outside LA. He says the drought will keep firefighters busy.
This is the third year of an ongoing drought in Southern California. And we've kept records as it relates to rainfall for over 100 years. And this is the driest year on record. To date, we've had less than 1 inch of rainfall. And the fields and brush and trees here are the critical state, as you would see in the middle of the summer, as it relates to their dryness. So it's ripe for a large wildland fire.
Wildlife feels it. Fire departments feel it. Farmers feel it. That goes to the economy of California. Here's Mark Borba, has a farm in San Joaquin Valley. Told NBC a couple of weeks ago that the drought has upended his plans. It's having a knock-on economic effect.
This year we had four John Deere tractors ordered, and they were in excess of $800,000. And when the Bureau announced that it was likely a zero water allocation for the coming year, I went to the dealer and said, sorry, but I'm not going to be able to take them.
Governor Jerry Brown saying, look, we've got to acknowledge an era of limits. We've got to be efficient and elegant in living with that. Here's the governor.
I think the drought emphasizes that we do live in an era of limits, that nature has its boundaries, and we have to be as efficient and elegant in the way we live and the way we conduct ourselves.
We're going to look into the water situation in California, the food situation right behind it. A couple of smart California voices on water with us right now from Sacramento. Janine Jones joins us, Deputy Drought Manager and Interstate Resources Manager for the California Department of Water Resources. She's also on the Western States Water Council, the Colorado River Board of California. Janine Jones in Sacramento, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. A pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And with us from Berkeley, California, Heather Cooley, Co-Director of the Water Program at the Pacific Institute. Heather Cooley, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Janine, how do you stack this drought up? 13 drought emergencies since 1987. California is not a stranger to this state of affairs. How's this one stack up with what you faced before?
Well, historically speaking, 1977 was our driest year of record in many parts of the state. within our historical record, and currently in some parts of the state, including our key water sources in the Sierra Nevada, which feeds the Sacramento and San Joaquin River systems, to date we are drier than 1977, although we still have, you know, time left in the water year to run.
When the governor says worst in a century, what does he mean then if you're looking at 77?
Well, he was referring to the fact that right now we are worse than 77 for this time at the end of January.
So there's still a chance here. Heather Cooley, I was talking with friends up near Sonoma over the weekend. They've got apple orchard there and just dry as they've ever seen it in a long time in California. They said some hope of rain on Thursday. Could all this change with a rain or two, Heather?
No, absolutely not. I mean, a rain or two is not really going to dig us out of the hole that we're currently in. It will help, certainly, especially in areas that are dependent on local resources, on local reservoirs. But one or two rainfall events will not help. We need much more rain than that. It's fairly unlikely that we will get to normal by the end of the season, even if we had a fairly sort of wet couple of months. So we need to be planning and preparing for less water.
Janine, you're on the Western States Water Council. We look at the maps of drought, and there's been drought all over the West, into the Rockies, beyond. As far as Texas, they've had really bad circumstances lately. What's the broader regional picture? Is California alone in this drought or not, Janine?
Well, right now we are that red spot on the map of the U.S. where we are drier than most of our neighbors. We seem to take turns being drier, as you alluded to. Texas had a very rocky stretch recently. But also important to point out that the Colorado River Basin, which is an important source of imported water for Southern California, has been in long-term drought, with 11 out of the past 14 water years being below average. So perhaps, as some suggest, this is a foretaste of things to come as we look at long-term impacts of climate change.
Heather, what about that? This time, more than I can remember in the past, people are saying, yes, harbinger of things to come, and there are big changes that are needed. Why that perspective on this drought, Heather?
Well, I think there's just growing recognition of the impacts of climate change and what it will mean for our water resources. The science has gotten better. We have a better idea from the models that have been run. There's just growing recognition. And so when these events do happen, we do realize that the change is occurring. We are seeing that the snowpack is much lower than historical averages. We're seeing earlier runoff in our rivers and streams. And so we are seeing the things that the models have said will happen.
Janine, what about the models? What are they projecting? Is it going to be a familiar rhythm, or are we heading into new terrain here on drought?
Well, a couple of the take-home messages from the global climate change modeling that's been done for California is that extremes become more extreme, whether you're talking wet side or dry side, and also that by the end of the century, for example, a lot of our mountain snowpack will have diminished. The interesting thing is that we've already been seeing this increase in variability very recently. Just the last few water years, we might start out, for example, with record wet conditions early in a water year. Suddenly the faucet turns off, we're in record dry. Something else that we're seeing, and next month we'll be releasing some reconstructions of paleo stream flows for the Sacramento, San Joaquin, and Klamath River basins, we're seeing that the last 100 years or so, which represents our historical record, shows much more variability in the record than literally hundreds to 1,000 years of reconstructed stream flows. And this is something that the models tell us that we should be expecting from climate change. So while the scientists will tell you that you can't attribute any single event to climate change, looking at the broad context, it certainly seems like we're heading in that direction.
I'm not sure that I followed you on variability. If you had more variability in the 20th century than the long record would suggest, has that been a good thing for settlement in California, or bad? What does that mean, variability?
Variability means that the swings between wet and dry conditions are much larger. So we might have periods of near record dry, near record wet, and typically that makes it more difficult to design water infrastructure because you need to make your water infrastructure larger and more robust so that you can capture these wide swings. This is why, for example, on the Colorado River system, where we're fortunate to have very large amounts of storage, the impacts of the drought there haven't been felt by water users. But in our Sacramento-San Joaquin River system, which is the bulk of much of our developed supplies here in California, it's a different kind of system and we don't have the luxury of that much storage. And these rapid swings between flood and drought conditions are very difficult to manage from an infrastructure standpoint.
I want to look at that. Let me get our listeners in as well, if I may. Janine Jones, Heather Cooley, stand by. Pam's calling from Amesbury, Massachusetts. Pam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I lived through that drought way back in the 70s, and I don't think our family has ever recovered in terms of our consciousness of water conservation. My washes, I used the same wash water three times, first for sheets and towels, the next for whites, and next for the darks, and then I pumped the water out to the trees in my front yard. Marin had enough water for about 3 weeks until they built the pipeline over from the East Bay. And I think we used to feel that the people in Southern California never realized or appreciated water conservation to the level as those of us in Northern California or the middle areas. I'd like to know what kind of all-state kind of rulings, or other than do not wash your car, or you wash your car every other day, are being enacted right now, because
you've been there, and it's very real to you. We can hear that, Pam. If I may, let me take that to Heather. What is being asked of Californians now in terms of water use and maybe changes in lifestyle, Heather?
Well, Pam, that's a really great point. Now, I too grew up in California, and certainly past droughts was what instilled conservation and efficiency within me and within sort of my habits. So statewide, the governor has called for a 20% voluntary cut in water use. And then you, in different regions, what you're seeing are both voluntary and in some cases mandatory restrictions. So in some areas, people are being asked not to water on certain days or not to water their lawns at all. You're seeing people being asked to go to car washing facilities that recycle water rather than using their hose and then losing that water down the drain. So you are seeing in spots of California some mandatory restrictions. On a statewide level, and this actually went back to our previous drought, our 2007-2009 drought, there also was a call, a mandatory call, for reducing per capita water use in California by 20% by the year 2020. So that's sort of a long-term trend that's happening, and that's being punctuated sort of by these drought responses.
Robert in Franklin, Kentucky. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The last week, I watched some of the Farmers Insurance golf tournament in San Diego. And as I watched, I noticed how green and very rich and healthy the grass looked, and all of the trees and all the other plants around there likewise were very green and healthy looking. And of course, there is the general drought in the state. So my question is, was all of the greenery, or is all of the greenery in the golf course a result of the regular rains, or was the course artificially watered?
That's a great question, Robert. Thanks for it. Janine, what about it? Your lush green golf courses, do they have protected water supply, natural rainfall? It doesn't look like drought to our listener in Kentucky.
Well, first of all, San Diego's had a very dry season, not only this year, but the last 2 years. So that wasn't rainfall. In California, it's a drought every summer, so to speak, because it doesn't rain in the summer. So everything is irrigated. That said, most golf courses use a lot of recycled water rather than potable water. And also, communities prioritize water use for their major industrial and commercial customers. In other words, they don't want to hurt the economy by cutting off water supplies for things that bring in revenues. So golf courses, even though they may seem like a high water user, when you factor in recycled water and the fact that they are an income generator for communities, they are normally looked at from that viewpoint in terms of the water that's available to them.
There's a lot to juggle when the water gets short. I want to look at food in particular, which the whole country has a very real interest in. Christy in Seville, Ohio. Christy, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi. What are you thinking?
Hi. I just think that possibly this drought is pointing us to the fact that we need to not rely on certain areas of the country for, you know, our food production, and lower our expectations that we would have tomatoes and strawberries year-round and go back to eating maybe locally and in season from the areas where we live.
So it's making you think about bringing your food dependence closer to home. Let us pick that up, Christy. I appreciate your call. Daniel Sumner joins us right now from Davis, California. He's director of the University of California's Agricultural Issues Center, professor of ag and resource economics at UC Davis. Daniel Sumner, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
Where does this drought hit California food production?
There's a couple of things to say quickly. And I think your previous guests have done a great job in making it clear the geography of California, and therefore the water plumbing system, is really quite complex. So
grand scale plumbing. We're not talking kitchen sink here. We're talking great.
That's right. So I'm talking
movements.
About the Colorado River versus the San Joaquin versus mm-hmm. the Sacramento River.
Yep.
And the first thing to say is don't worry about your California strawberries. That's in a different system. And in fact, the Monterey area, where much of the produce, the fresh produce and the strawberries, et cetera, come from, haven't featured in this conversation at all yet today, because they're really not facing the kind of severity that the Central Valley is.
Why? Where does their water come from, Daniel, in that produce area?
They're mostly groundwater pumping, and if you get to Monterey, we're talking about extremely high-value crops where people have developed water, and they don't use a lot of water per acre. Or
crops like what?
Lettuce, strawberries, artichokes, mm-hmm. Celery, peppers, mm-hmm. Broccoli. Sort of think of the produce aisle.
Yeah,
and those are mostly coming not from the Central Valley of California, the San Joaquin we've had so much conversation about, mm-hmm. but these more coastal valleys, and some of them from down in this time of year, from down in Imperial, which is on the Colorado River system.
Does drought not ultimately relate to groundwater availability?
Oh, it will, but again, quite different systems, so that we could be pumping from hundreds of feet in the Central Valley and have much more access to groundwater over the hill. Remember, between the Central Valley and the Monterey coast, you go up 2,000 or 3,000 feet and back down to sea level. Mm-hmm. So they're really on different water systems. Now, I don't want to minimize the longer-term pressure on the Monterey Valley. That system also faces some pressure from salinization and other sorts of things. But I want to focus for your listeners on the Central Valley, because that's the current and much more immediate issue.
And dairy is a big factor there.
It is a very big factor. The number one crop is grapes, and wine grapes, table grapes, and raisins, all three. It's not your Sonoma County grapes. Most of us can't afford that wine, not very often. But the Central Valley produces well more than half the wine produced in California, and there will be pressure on those vines, and almonds and pistachios and pomegranates and tree fruits and walnuts. So I've just gone down a list of tree and vine crops. And one thing a bit different about this drought relative to the one several years ago and even 5 years ago is we continue to plant more acres of these tree and vine crops. And that means farmers have less flexibility. You don't idle an almond orchard, or you don't fallow it. You have to have enough water to keep those trees alive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about California's big drought, drought emergency now. Heather Cooley is with us from the Pacific Institute's Water Program. Janine Jones is here from the California Department of Water Resources. And Daniel Sumner, director of the University of California's Agricultural Issues Center at UC Davis. Questions for you, dear panel. Mike in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Mike. You're on.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The reason I'm calling is that I read a history of Southern California, and they, in fact, said that the last century, or a little bit more than that, was actually a very wet one based on historical data, and that we're not actually going through a drought now. We're just going back to historical norms, and we were just very either unlucky or lucky to have settled in that region during the last century and a half.
That's interesting. Heather Cooley, what about the historical record here and what it may say about the potential future?
Well, your caller is right. There is some new evidence that suggests that we have been in a relatively wet period. And so we could be going back into more of our historical norm, or we could be, as climate change can be intensifying some of these droughts that we're experiencing, some of the wet periods we're experiencing. And so it is something we need to be thinking about. We need to be building more flexible systems, both for our agricultural systems and our urban systems, and thinking about how we are going to adapt to this new norm.
Janine, I don't know how bad this could get, and I don't know what the big plans are. I'm sure you do. I'm looking at a story here from a few years back saying that California, if you look deeper in the tree rings and the deep historical record, California has had periods of drought lasting two centuries, another one lasting a century and a half. I mean, that sounds apocalyptic, Janine. I'm not saying that's where we're headed, but people are saying it could be tougher. Given the scale of agriculture in California, given the scale of the population, is it clear that with more efficiency, more conservation, more infrastructure, that California is going to be able to deal, Janine?
Well, something we need to think about, Tom, is that we look at drought and water infrastructure management through the lens of a very short time within the historical record. And you mentioned those periods of decades or centuries even of very dry conditions. There is a classic thing called the medieval mega drought or the medieval climate anomaly all of North America pretty much experienced during, obviously, the medieval times. And if we were to be living in those kinds of conditions now, the infrastructure, our settlement patterns and everything would be very different from what they are now. However, that was an event that happened essentially one prolonged time in the last millennium. What we've experienced in the recent past and the more historical time frames, we've had dry cycles, and in fact, our tree ring records for the Sacramento River system, for example, show that within the last 500 years, we haven't seen anything worse in the historical record. The question is more one of keeping track of going on and being prepared to shift to a more adaptive framework if we see signs that we are moving into those extreme conditions. Certainly one would question, could California support 38 million people if we were living in a rerun of the medieval mega drought? And the answer to that would probably be no.
Daniel Sumner, you all must be thinking big. Big picture here, if we've got climate change going on and it's going to mean changes, maybe a drier California, how do you see California agriculture adapting? Is it guaranteed that this continues to be a big producer for the country? Are there parts of your agricultural life that might change radically or even disappear?
I think the answer is things will change radically, and they have been. California a century ago was the nation's second biggest wheat producer. That doesn't happen much anymore. We've shifted really rapidly but along decade scales, out of field crops and towards permanent crops that can be irrigated with drips. The biggest change that I think, and something that's actually optimistic, is that if we were to get the institutions and politics right, we could be far more efficient in the use of the water in agriculture, and that's partly allowing water to move to highest and best uses across water districts, encouraging more careful use of water. We still do some flood irrigation in some places where that probably wouldn't make any sense if we priced things appropriately. So there's really a lot we can do. If you just look at the raw data and say agricultural value per acre foot of agricultural water, it's really gone up quite remarkably. If you think of the sort of technical change and institutional change and other things farmers have done. The one thing I want to emphasize, it's not so much that what we're facing right now from climate change is necessarily drier periods. That may happen, but especially we're pretty secure that the form of precipitation is more rain and less snow, which means if you're going to have a storage, and I think your first guest, Bettina, made this point very clearly. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have storage, we're not so lucky anymore to have this free storage in the form of snow.
Snow is a very elegant kind of frozen reservoir until you need it.
Yeah, and that may mean if we're going to keep anything like the population and anything like the agriculture that we have, we have to figure out a better way to store water. Now, if that's off the table, if we can't improve the plumbing system or the storage system for political reasons, then I do see we've got some severe times.
Very broad stroke. What would that require if you're imagining replacing all that snow storage in effect of the Sierra Nevada with, what, reservoirs somewhere? Describe what that would look like.
Yeah, not all of it. And I'm going to turn to Bettina, Janine, who's the real expert on that topic about
okay.
where and how and all that. But we do know that we have potential to divert, whether it's a little more storage in Shasta or another 5 or 10% in some reservoirs that are already built or a few additional reservoirs or a canal here and there or a tunnel here and there. I think there are things that can be done. But a big part of it is institutional, changing the incentives across water districts for people to be more careful in their water use.
Janine, what about it? If you've only got 17% of the normal snowpack now, it's kind of a shocking number. Daniel's imagining a climate change future where snow plays a smaller part, rain a greater part. First of all, what about that formula? If the snow's not there, do you presume that rain will be? And if you do have fluid instead of snow, how do you hang on to it and distribute it?
Well, that's actually a very good point, because the climate change models for California, although they're not nearly as accurate with respect to precipitation as they are with respect to temperature, the models pretty clearly agree that Southern California trends drier, but that Northern California may actually be a couple of percentage points wetter.
Mm-hmm.
However, the increase in temperature alone is what can kill our snowpack, and what many people in your listenership may not realize is that we actually operate on a very delicate balance in our Sierra Nevada system between flood control and water storage
mm-hmm.
for urban agricultural environmental purposes. And snowpack plays a critical role in that, because all of our existing infrastructure was designed with the idea that we had this reservoir up there that would hold the water in a frozen state during the winter months when we need flood control protection, and then gradually it would melt in the spring and summer. We could fill our reservoirs, use that water for water supply. What climate change will do is disrupt that delicate balance, and we'll be getting a lot more water in the form of rain or liquid water at times when we may not be able to handle it for flood control in the Central Valley, which is the most flood-prone area of the state. So in terms of near-term adaptation actions, one of the things that people are looking at is called reservoir reoperation. Because our existing large reservoirs in the Sierras, many of which were built 50, 60, 70 years ago, were built with Corps of Engineer flood control restrictions embodied in them, which says that thou shalt operate the reservoir under these conditions to leave this much space vacant all winter long, mm-hmm. period.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to change what we call that reservoir rule curve. In many cases, it may require an act of Congress or certainly require a major process through the National Environmental Policy Act, not something that will be easy to achieve.
But are you saying those reservoirs could be repurposed to capture rainwater somehow, Janine?
Well, something that will buy us some time, perhaps a decade or two, not sure how long, is to tweak these operating rules,
yep.
which are relatively cast in concrete, and that will buy us time to figure out how we do the longer-term adaptation measures that require, for example, building more storage and so forth. But maintaining that balance for flood control and water supply is critical.
Heather, is it imaginable to you that you'd lose the snowpack factor here over time and replace it with some kind of vast infrastructure equivalent to the Sierra Nevada but elsewhere capturing rain? Is that doable, Heather?
Well, one of the things I want to point to is we've talked about building storage, but the fact of the matter is we have a lot of storage in the form of overdraft in our groundwater aquifers, and that's something we haven't yet talked about
when
today.
What do you mean by that? Spare capacity, empty aquifer space? What is that it?
Yeah, so groundwater is largely unregulated in California, with the exception of in adjudicated basins. And so what that has done is that over time, we have seen groundwater levels decline. That's bad news in some cases because there's less of that water available. But it might be good news in that we can take some of these excess flows in the wintertime that we're getting more precipitation as rain, mm-hmm. and we can then recharge groundwater so that we then have higher groundwater levels. That's groundwater that we can draw down and rely upon during these drought periods. And in fact, that's something we've done in California in the past, relying on groundwater. And it's something that we could be doing and managing much better than we are today. So that must be part of what we're thinking about in terms of adapting to climate change in the long term. We also need to be thinking about water reuse and recycling. We dump a lot of water in our coastal areas, particularly. We use water once, and then we dump it into the ocean, and that creates water quality problems in the ocean. Increasingly, you're seeing communities take that water, treat it to very high standards, and either reuse it or use it to recharge groundwater that they can then reuse for other purposes. So we have a lot of opportunity there. We have a lot of opportunity still in water conservation and efficiency. So yes, climate change is going to have major impacts. Drought will continue to be a problem, but there are many solutions and many ways of building a more robust and resilient California.
Mike in Southington, Connecticut. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Quick question. If we can pump oil sands all the way from Canada to Texas, why can't we build desalination plants and have water for all of California? 1,500 miles of oil sands, I would think we'd be able to do a water. It's more important.
Okay, we'll pick it up, Mike. Janine, what about it? Just take that Pacific Ocean, desalinate, and pump it all over.
There's a really simple one-word answer, and that's money. Desalination is expensive in terms of the energy resources that are needed to run the desal process, and it's also expensive in terms of conveyance. We already move water over very long distances in California. In fact, our state water project system entails more than 600 miles worth of facilities moving water from the far northern part of California to the far south. However, in theory, yes, we could build desal plants all along the coast and supply the state that way. The cost, relatively speaking, would be astronomical.
As in what multiple of current costs?
Well, let's put it this way. San Diego County Water Authority has recently signed into a long-term contract for what will be the largest desal plant on the West Coast, which is now under construction. And by the time they desalt that water and serve it to their member agencies, the marginal cost of that water for some of those customers is going to be in the ballpark of $2,000 per acre foot.
As compared to what for the water supply now?
200?
Well,
200, so maybe 10
yeah,
times
or
more expensive.
20, depending on where you are.
Or,
you know, the big issue here is that mm-hmm. you got to remember we're in a system with lots of mountains, and it takes even if you had cheap desalinization on the coast, you got to pump it over a mountain range to get it in to irrigate a central valley.
It's a lot more expensive than using gravity just to let it flow down.
Gravity's got a lot going for it.
Hey, we can see that cost differential is huge. Daniel, if we see cutbacks in the Central Valley, what about the international system for food now? Do all those things just get replaced with that? Some of those grapes and wine and pistachios and almonds go away for a while or are severely cut back? What happens?
Oh, well, I don't see us cutting back on the tree and vine crops this year.
Okay.
Not very much. I see us diverting water from processing tomatoes, so I'm not suggesting your listeners want to go out and grab all the tomato paste on the shelf, but I would expect there to be an effect on the processing tomato business and maybe a few of the annual crops. We're not going to grow as much cotton, but people won't notice that in the price of a cotton shirt. But I think, at least for this year, we'll keep the tree and vine crops going. And I think we're going to make the kind of institutional changes to keep that part of the industry square. Now, if you think about what we grow in the Central Valley, we're an important part of the world supply, that is the wine grapes. We're important in the world wine grape market. California grows a substantial share and exports most of the world's almonds. So in the long haul, almonds are important in the whole world market and a few other things. But among the Central Valley crops, which are the ones that are under pressure for the next year or two, I think people are okay.
And longer term, if you've got pressure up around the Monterey, and some of that begins to be hit?
Well, that's right. Then you're, if we end up cutting back the number of acres of lettuce, for example, that are grown in the springtime or celery or mm-hmm. some of the other produce crops, you'll see somewhat higher prices. And this is going to work through a price system. That I guess that's the way people ought to be thinking about it.
Janine, in a word, California sustainable long term on the waterfront?
Where we have the will, we have the way.
Boy, it may take a lot of will, and we hope you've got it. We hope it can work out. Big challenge right now with the drought emergency on. We've learned a lot in this hour. I'm grateful for that. Janine Jones with the California Department of Water Resources. Thank you so much, Janine.
Pleasure to be here.
Daniel Sumner at UC Davis and the Agricultural Issues Center there. Professor Sumner, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Heather Cooley at the Pacific Institute. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.